providing life support to the aliens, he fairly spat in disgust. In desperate times, hard decisions must be made. That is the nature of leadership. His followers gazed at him with rapt attention, knowing Biff was the person they needed to make the tough decisions, the unpleasant decisions, the necessary decisions. The decisions that had to be made soon, or they would all die. Dotha was not competent when he acted, and he was never authorized to appoint Perkins to command, so his action is invalid, Biff declared, and his followers looked at each other and nodded with grim expressions. We need to act, or the ship is doomed. We need to act now. It is our duty. Biff picked up the wrench again, tapping the head forcefully into a palm. Who is with me? With the help of cadets who knew the ship much better than he did, Dave found a way to the engineering compartment using passageways inside the ship. Where the way was not clear, the cadets sliced away obstructions with plasma torches, cut power to relays that were sparking, and restored emergency power to stuck bulkhead doors. Shortly after testing that the way was indeed as safe as it could be made, Dave led a group of engineering cadets back to speak with Jin Garner, and most of them went back up the passageway with Dave to begin making repairs as directed by Jin, with a few cadets remaining to work on the puzzling task of determining if it was safe to restart a reactor. Perkins visibly relaxed, or at least visibly was no longer feeling the weight of an entire planet on her shoulders. Another group of cadets came to get instructions, accompanied by the other Verdkris aboard, a male with the rank of Sergon named Krokostal Jates. He was older than Dave, and naturally assumed authority, although he deferred to Perkins without apparent resentment. The Mavericks had trained with Jates only 3 times, as he was already fully qualified for spaceborne duty, and his role aboard the ship was to train Ruhar cadets in real-life space infantry tactics, whether they liked it or not. When the cadets were leaving to go perform whatever critical tasks were needed elsewhere in the ship, Jates lingered behind. Perkins was huddled with Jin Garner, providing moral support and encouragement, since she had no idea how most systems aboard the ship worked, when with the corner of her eye she saw more cadets come floating in through the open hatch. She ignored them, until she could not.
Nobody move!
The shout rang out in the compartment. Perkins spun to see who had spoken, her mind flashing to scenarios of someone warning of a dangerous condition with a power relay or some other technical problem. She was astonished to see a group of 3 Ruhar cadets pointing weapons at her. Biff held a rifle, and his 2 friends had sidearms. The ranking cadet made a show of holding the rifle in dramatic fashion at his hip, keeping the muzzle trained on Perkins.
I said nobody move! That means all of you!
He glared angrily around the compartment, sounding like a bank robber in an old movie. Everyone stay where you are, Perkins ordered. Cadet Kulsoon, what do you think you are doing?
I don't have to think anything. I am taking control of this ship back from you. I am assuming command, effective immediately. No alien should be in command of our warships.
He shot a look of hatred at Jates, who had made a fool of Biff during several training exercises.
No alien should be aboard one of our ships unless they are in the brig.
Perkins took a breath to keep the fear from her voice. It didn't work. Where did you get those weapons? The armory is locked down. It was locked down. She knew that for certain because her initial tour of the ship had included the armory, or technically the heavy door of the armory. Even the executive officer giving her the tour did not have authorization to open the armory door. Perkins had been surprised by that bit of information. She was even more surprised to learn the toaster had an armory. Why did a training ship need live weapons, she had asked. The XO had explained the armory was left over from when the cruiser was a frontline warship, and it had been kept in case the Rue Tostella needed to quickly be returned to fleet service.
It was locked, Biff replied with a smirk. You are as ignorant as you are stupid and primitive. This is our ship. We know how to bypass security measures.
He winked at his friends, who grinned back, pleased at his cleverness. That would take an impressive level of skill, Jate said in an admiring tone, while with his eyes he gave Perkins a look she could not interpret.
Was the Kristang going to join the mutiny, to save himself and Tutula? Or was something else going on? Let me guess. You cut through the power circuits behind the bulkhead to the armory?
Good guess, Sergeant Jaitz, Bift replied with a frown, unhappy about a member of an enemy species knowing such dangerous secrets about a Ruhar warship, even a ship as obsolete as the Rue to Stella.
I suggest you forget such knowledge.
What next? Perkins had used the time to regain her courage. She was determined to defy the little shit cadet and not let him see her sweat. You kill us? Throw us out an airlock?
No. Although, as you are an enemy species, and you unlawfully took control of a warship, I would be within my rights under combat conditions to kill all of you,
Bift bluffed, knowing that was a lie.
We're not in combat now.
Dave pushed himself forward and Perkins restrained him with one hand.
Do not be afraid, little fool. I don't plan to kill you. Not directly. We will put your kind and the two Kristang into a dropship with its flight controls disabled. You will float away.
The cadet leader made a mocking gesture, miming an object spinning slowly through space.
Once you are beyond communications range, the ship will deactivate your command authority.
He glared at Perkins.
Command will then fall to the next senior officer,
he gloated, pointing to his chest. That is an interesting plan. A good plan, Jake said.
Thank...
Bift reacted to the praise before he could remind himself that he didn't care what an enemy species thought of him. Too bad. Jates made a honking sound and sent a thick wad of spit spinning through the air toward the three armed cadets. You won't ever get to put your plan into action, you dumb little shit.
What?
Bift's aim wavered as he flailed his legs awkwardly to avoid being splattered with the disgusting projectile. Held steady by his two friends, he regained his composure and pointed the rifle at the Verdcris.
I could shoot you!
Ha! I've seen you with a rifle, Bifty boy. Safest place for me if you're shooting is right where I am, because you'll never hit me from there.
I...
The senior cadet's finger was flexing on the trigger, and Perkins reached out to restrain Jates, but the Verdcris warrior was not to be interfered with.
What? Did I hurt your widow feelings? Jake sneered. You want to run to your mama because I said mean things to you? Would widow Bifty boy like his mommy to pat his furry widow head and make the bad words stop?
I swear I will shoot you right here.
One of Bift's friends tried to whisper something in the agitated cadet's ear, but he was not listening.
You stay back. I'm warning you.
He shouted at Jates, gesturing with the rifle that was now properly held to his shoulder, his bravado gone.
Boy, Jates said in a low, calm voice as he drifted toward the three mutinous cadets. You either give that rifle to someone who knows how to use it, or you pull that trigger. We all know you don't have the guts to shoot me, so stop making a fool out of yourself and surrender that weapon.
I'll do it. I swear I'll do it. He's coming at me.
Bift's head swiveled to his friends for support.
You saw this. I have no choice.
Bift, he's just, one of his friends pleaded.
You asked for this,
Bift bellowed as Jates drew within arm's length of the muzzle.
This is your fault.
He squeezed the trigger gently as he had been taught, though his eyes partly closed, which was not proper procedure. Nothing happened. Frantically, Bift swam backwards in the air, one eye on the oncoming Jates, and the other checking the rifle's safety and power meters. They were both set correctly, so why was the rifle not firing? Were the Mazer exciters burned out? With one finger, he switched to flechette rounds, even though he knew using that ammunition could cause carnage in the compartment. Nothing happened. Jates reached out with lightning-fast speed and snatched the rifle from Biff's hands, breaking two of the cadets' fingers as the bigger and stronger Verdcris yanked it away. The two other cadets shot at Jates, but they too had no results as their sidearms refused to fire. Almost casually, Jates spun the rifle around in his hands and bashed Biff in the face with the butt, sending the senior cadet spinning off toward the still-open main door with blood spraying from his broken nose. Flipping the rifle around and setting it against his shoulder, Jates faced the two other would-be mutineers.
Are you two going to be smart and hand over those pistols, or will you give me the pleasure of bashing your stupid heads together?
The Ruhar looked at each other in a brief moment of panic before swallowing hard and meekly handing their pistols to the hulking Verdgris, who tucked them into the tool belt of his spacesuit. Emily Perkins felt she could dare breathe again after a shameful moment of not knowing what to do. Sergeant Jaitz had years of experience dealing with and training Ruhar cadets, so she had let him take the lead. But if he had been killed, she knew it would be her fault.
Sergeant Jaitz, she emphasized his rank. That was a terrible risk. Do not do anything like that again, she scolded while suppressing a shudder of relief.
I was in no danger. Jaitz slung the rifle over one shoulder and waved for Biff's friends to attend to the cadet who had tried to forcefully take over the ship.
These weapons will not fire.
I saw that, Perkins admitted. How did you know that? Have all the weapons in the armory been disabled?
No, just these, and any others this amateur gang of morons stole from the armory. All weapons inside the armory should be fully active.
How did you know about that? Dave whispered in amazement. If these Ruhar cadets didn't know, how?
Jaitz tilted his head in a gesture like a shrug. The officers of the Ruhar fleet are not concerned about their own cadets attempting to seize control. Not so with aliens such as we Verdgris. We are still not fully trusted. During our initial orientation tour of this ship, the officer guiding us made a point of telling us not to ever think about breaking into the armory, because any attempt to breach security there would render those weapons useless. Any weapon removed from the armory without proper authorization is automatically disabled by the weapon itself, sending a power surge to fry its control chip. That is why I carry this.
Jake flipped the rifle over, opened a port with one finger, and extracted a copper-colored flat square. He tossed it to go drifting away, pulled an identical unit from a pocket, and inserted it in the rifle.
This fire control unit is active, the lizard announced with a grin that stretched his lips in an expression more terrifying than reassuring. Sighting on a broken piece of equipment lazily floating near the far bulkhead, he fiddled with the selector and squeezed the trigger. A maser beam blasted the target, sending hot droplets of metal to splatter the bulkhead and making everyone in the compartment duck and cover their faces. The next time a Ruhar cadet tells you how their species is so smart, remember this.
Dave and Perkins exchanged a silent, oh shit, look. A Kristang held the only active weapon aboard the ship. Was he now going to seize control of the Ruta Stella, kill the humans and Ruhar, or simply throw them in the brig and try to signal the Kristang warship? If a Verdgris warrior wanted to join the Kristang warrior caste, bringing them a Ruhar warship full of cadet hostages might be a good way to prove his worth. Perkins saw Dave tense to launch himself at Jaitz, and her heart froze in fear for her young sergeant.
Here. Jaitz flipped the rifle around and handed it to Dave. You should hold this.
Dave was so shocked, he did not at first reach out for the rifle, believing it had to be a trick. When his hands wrapped around the rifle and Jaitz released it, Dave pulled it close to his chest, pointed it between his feet, and safed it.
You sure about this? Dave asked before he could stop his stupid mouth.
The cadets would never accept me as commander. There is too much hate and distrust between our peoples, Jaitz explained sadly. The Ruhar consider the Verdgris, like you humans, as pets. He jerked his head toward Bift, who are indulged too much by our masters. Colonel Perkins, if we have any chance to survive this disaster, we need you to lead us.
Jaitz gave her a proper U.S. military salute.
Emily Perkins's internal reaction was to resent the pressure put on her. She wanted someone else to be responsible for a change, dammit. If the fates were determined to torment her, why couldn't they give her an easy challenge once in a while? She returned the salute.
Sergeant Jaitz, do you have any more of those magical control chips?
Only one more, and it was in part of the ship that sustained significant battle damage.
So, she pointed to the rifle Dave carried, that's the only active weapon aboard the ship?
Yes.
That I know of. Perkins tilted her head.
We must trust each other, Jates replied with an unreadable expression. The alien was right, she knew. Sergeant Chaka, you and Jates escort the mutineers to the brig. Dave made a show of flicking off the safety of his rifle. Ma'am, there are probably other cadets involved in the mutiny. What about them? Unless we know specifically who was involved, they are all innocent until proven guilty. We need everyone we can get to repair the ship. I would like to consider this, well, this incident closed for now. The Ruhar authorities can deal with the legal matters when we contact the fleet. By his expression, Dave did not like that idea. Yes, ma'am. If anyone even looked at him funny, Dave intended to throw them in the brig and ask questions later. No way was he going to take any shit from punk hamster kids. Perkins turned her attention to the Cristang, or, she corrected herself, Verdgris. Sergeant Jates. Yes, Colonel. Make sure these cadets don't know any tricks about breaking out of the brig. That drew a smile from the Verdgris, an expression that was not quite revolting. Yes, Colonel. After Dave departed with Biff and his crew, Perkins floated over to Jin's workstation. Do you have an initial assessment?
No, the Ruhar girl stammered, her hands shaking.
She wasn't ready for the crushing responsibility, she knew it, and she also could not just walk away. The entire crew was counting on her.
Colonel, even if the reactors can be restarted, I don't dare feed energy into the ship. There are too many power conduits with open circuits and other systems that might blow if unregulated power is fed into them. We need to get the entire ship forward to frame 67.
She pointed to the thick bulkhead to the aft, which protected delicate biological systems from the radiation of the reactors and jump drive.
Isolated. I don't have enough people to do that. Enough people who know how to do that. I can't be here and also manage the work teams.
Understood. Garner, take a deep breath. Perkins put a hand on the cadet's shoulder.
You can do this.
How?
Jin waved her fingers at the console in front of her, densely cluttered with confusing data, all of which needed her focused attention.
It is impossible.
Don't tell me about impossible, cadet. Perkins kept her tone soft and reassuring. My team destroyed a Cristang battlegroup using ancient maser cannons that no one knew even existed. Later, we were trapped on an island with an enemy commando squad and no weapons, and we found a way to kill every one of those murderous lizards.
Yes, ma'am,
Jin replied with a faint smile. The fact that she could smile at all was a good sign.
You keep working here. I'll find a way to get those work teams organized. Respectfully, Colonel. You don't know this ship's systems.
Correct. But I know someone who does. On the way to patching another leak in the hull, Nert stopped by the brig. His helmet was off, attached to his belt with a strap. But clearly he had been wearing the helmet for an extended period while working hard, for the fur on his head was plastered down with dried sweat, and the helmet liner had created a crease across his forehead.
Hello, Miss Shauna.
He greeted the human with weary good cheer. While Nert, Dave, and Jesse usually used nicknames for each other, the two soldiers had not thought up an acceptable nickname for Shauna. Jesse's attempt to call her Nuke, merely because her actions had erased an entire island from the surface of paradise, had not gone well.
How are you?
Before Shauna could answer, Biff elbowed one of his fellow mutineers to get attention while he insulted the young cadet.
Oh, Nert, did you come here to make sure your pet isn't lonely?
You'll be quiet, Biff.
Nert jabbed a finger at the senior cadet, his expression filled with anger and disgust.
The ship is in crisis. We need everyone working on damage control. And you?
He shook a fist while trying to think what to say.
You are useless as a knitted condom.
Nerdy.
Shauna couldn't help laughing.
Is that something you learned from the 3rd Infantry?
No.
He looked puzzled.
I heard Kornpon saying it to Ski. Did I not use that expression correctly? It is a very colorful phrase.
It is very colorful, yes.
She covered her mouth with a hand so the cadets in the brig would not see she could not stop laughing.
It is also true.
She scowled at Biff, and with that, the humor was gone.
How are you?
Nert pointed to the patch kit strapped to his waist.
I fear there are more holes in the hull than we have patches to fix. My team leader thinks we must do what we can by starting near the engineering control center and working our way forward.
That is stupid, Biff protested. You should first conduct a survey of the ship and then prioritize critical selections. If we don't secure the life support systems before they sustain more damage, we will all die out here soon.
You had a chance to help, Biff?
Nert waved a hand at the disgraced senior cadet with a dismissive gesture, something that would have astonished Nert mere hours ago. The attempted mutiny had made Biff's status fall so far, Nert no longer cared what his former cadet leader thought about anything.
Now, the best thing you can do to help is stop breathing, to conserve oxygen for people working to fix the ship. Miss Shauna, I must go now. I will be back when I can.
You don't worry about me, Nerdy. I'll be fine.
Shauna wanted to be doing something more valuable than babysitting cadets who were securely locked behind bars, but she understood humans were pretty much just in the way for the task of repairing the sophisticated alien starship. Still, Irene and Derek were practicing to fly and jump the ship if main power could be restored, while Jesse and Dave were part of a work crew patching holes in the hull. Humans did not need to understand hyperspatial navigation to slap patches on holes in the inner hull, and Shauna was itching to get away from the brig soon. Shortly after Nert left, Perkins pulled herself into the chamber that led to the ship's brig. That compartment was larger than she expected aboard a training cruiser, but then it was likely left over from the toaster's service as a line ship. Biff and his two friends were floating in the center of the compartment. They were upside down from her normal perspective. Perkins thought the brats had done that deliberately to upset their single guard.
Jarrett, she nodded.
Ma'am,
Shauna patted the heavy wrench sitting in her lap.
Don't you worry. These jokers aren't going anywhere.
Colonel Perkins!
Biff mispronounced her name as Perkins because he knew that would annoy the human officer.
I have rights as a prisoner!
He ran a finger over the dried blood on his face where Jates had bashed him with the rifle and waggled his broken fingers.
You must offer proper medical attention to injured prisoners. I demand that you—
You demand nothing, you punk-ass little shit. Perkins was too tired to add the proper vehemence to her tone.
You are not a prisoner. You are guilty of a mutiny. I checked Ruhar fleet regulations and they are very clear. Anyone attempting a mutiny when a ship is in combat conditions only has a right to piss in their pants before they get thrown out an airlock. Your fleet, your people, are at war, cadet. They don't screw around. I admire that about your people.
You are an alien. You have no right to—
I am the commanding officer of this ship.
Perkins waved her Z-phone so Biff could see the full set of command codes.
You are not going to kill us.
Biff was regaining his arrogance. He reasoned if the human had the determination to throw him out an airlock, she would have done that already before she lost her nerve.
My family is powerful. You do not dare touch me.
Ma'am, please give me 2 minutes with that asshole.
Shauna thumped the wrench into the bulkhead behind her.
His face is beat up already. No one will know.
Don't waste the energy, Jarrett. Perkins frowned.
Have you come here to gloat, Miss Perkins?
Biff asked in a taunting tone he used for his friends, but the fear in his eyes revealed his true emotions.
No, I'm here to put your furry asses to work, Perkins explained simply.
That remark was completely unexpected. Biff could not respond until one of his friends nudged him. He tapped his earpiece.
I do not think that translated properly.
You heard me right.
Work.
If we're going to survive, we need to fix the ship, and I need all hands on deck for that. I can't have 3 able-bodied people wasting time in the brig just because one of you is stupid. She locked eyes with Biff.
We should put our trust in you,
Biff asked in a mocking tone.
You should put your trust in Urmat Datha. He chose to put me in command.
Seeing a chance for redemption and to regain his personal status, Biff folded his arms defiantly.
Why should we help?
First, because if you don't, everyone aboard this ship might die, including you three knuckleheads. Second, because no matter how powerful your parents are, the only thing your fleet command hates more than a mutiny is a failed mutiny. The rest of you, she directed her gaze at Biff's companions, might be able to claim you were misled by your cadet leader. But not if you refuse to assist in repairing the ship. Perkins could see the comment had struck home by the awkward movements of the other cadets and by the guilty looks they gave to their leader. The cadets may have followed Biff when they thought they could take the ship, but neither of them wanted to face punishment now that the mutiny had failed. Cadet Coulson, I need someone to prioritize assignments and organize work parties. That surprised Biff more than anything else Perkins had said.
You want me to lead the repair effort?
No, I need you to direct and coordinate the cadet teams that will be doing the work. Cadet Garner has an engineering team working on overall plans to get the reactors restarted, but there is a lot of other work she needs done, and I can't take people with an engineering specialty away from their tasks. You are the cadet leader. I need you to lead. Biff knew the human was flattering him. At that moment, he did not care. She was offering him a way out of the deeply humiliating mess he had gotten himself into. Biff had not been able to admit it to his friends, but when the brig door had closed with a solid clanging sound of doom, he had almost broken down and cried from fear and embarrassment. He shuddered with relief, a tremble he could not hide from his friends.
"Should we shake hands? I believe that is the human custom."
Biff held a hand through the bars. "Cadet," Perkins tilted her head and pursed her lips in displeasure, "I am not making a deal with you. I am giving you an order as your commanding officer. You only have to obey." Biff stiffened, and his friends tensed for his reaction. What he did was unexpected. He pressed two fingers to his cheek in the Ruhar form of a salute.
"Understood and agreed, Colonel."
"Excellent. Sergeant Jates." As she spoke, the Verdgris came through the doorway. "We'll come with you to assist." Biff blanched at seeing the Verdgris, and he subconsciously wrapped his injured fingers with his other hand.
"We have to trust each other. But you send this person," he chose his words carefully, "to spy on me."
"I am not a spy, and I am not worried about you taking over the ship." Jates glared through the bars. "You have already proven to be totally incompetent of that. We will see whether you are competent to do anything aboard this ship." Biff knew he was not going to win the argument about Jates following him around the ship.
"If you are not watching me, what will you be doing?"
"My task is..." "Think of it as providing motivation."
"Motivation? How?"
Biff asked, his eyes flicking between the menacing Kristang and his friends who were clearly going to be no help at all. Jates pointed at the senior cadet. "Ass?" Then he pointed at his feet. "Meet boot." "Any questions?" Given a reprieve from death, or at least a long prison sentence, Biff threw himself into his assigned task with feverish energy. Perkins had to admit the cadet leader had excellent organizational skills and a natural charisma that made people want to follow him, finding herself forced to admire the job he was doing. He got Jin's list of tasks prioritized not only by level of potential danger to the ship, but also took into account which tasks could be combined to minimize the time required and risk to the teams working in hazardous conditions. Soon the repair teams began to fix things faster than they could break, and Jin Garner had time to think beyond the immediate crisis. When Biff, escorted by Jates, came to report progress to Perkins, Jin decided it was time to deliver the bad news. "We can get one reactor restarted," she told Perkins with a raised eyebrow, implying she was not entirely sure of her facts. "The other reactor is too damaged to attempt a restart."
"All right. All right, that's good then."
Perkins stifled a yawn. Damn, she was tired, and there was no prospect of her getting sleep any time soon. "The ship can run on one reactor?"
"It can, but that is not the problem. The containment shielding around the good reactor is damaged. We don't have enough replacement components, and we can't take shielding from the other reactor because damage to the second reactor is even more extensive.
The reactor will leak radiation?
Worse, it will leak plasma. Once plasma gets past containment, it will burn through the outer shielding. And then,
Jin made an exaggerated shrug,
we will lose the reactor, all systems near the reactor, and probably the ship.
Is there anything you can do to compensate?
Yes, we can run the reactor at very low power and periodically vent plasma to reduce the stress on the containment system. Colonel, there is only so much we can do to keep the containment from failing. My best guess is once the reactor is restarted, we will only have 10 days before it must be shut down permanently.
10 days?
Biff squeaked with dismay.
We can't go anywhere in 10 days.
The reactor isn't the only problem.
Jin ran a hand through her hair in a very human-like gesture, sweeping bangs out of her eyes.
It isn't even the most important problem. The battle group's reaction was not planned, so the fleet does not know where we were when the Bosphorak attacked. The fleet won't know we are missing for another 2 weeks, and a search could take months. Or more.
That assumes the fleet will conduct a search and rescue operation, Perkins mused, instantly regretting she had spoken aloud.
The fleet will search for us,
Biff declared indignantly.
My mother!
The Bosphorak may have launched a large-scale attack into Ruhar territory, Perkins explained. The fleet may not have the resources for a search operation, especially if they don't know there are any ships left to search for.
Oh.
Biff stared at his feet, chastened. Even his parents could not simply order a warship to search for their son if the fleet was hard-pressed responding to an incursion by the Bosphorak. However we're getting out of this, we need to plan to do it on our own. Perkins looked to Jin. What are our options?
That is the problem, Colonel. I do not see that we have any options. We have enough charge in the capacitors for several jumps, and at low power, the reactor could slowly recharge the capacitors for perhaps another 2 jumps before I have to shut down the reactor. You must understand, this ship is not capable of traveling to a star system with a habitable world from here. Even if all systems were operating perfectly, it is unlikely we could perform a flight between star systems before some critical component wore out. Our ships are not usually capable of interstellar flight, which is why we rely on Jarapha star carriers.
I did know that, Perkins replied with a measure of irritation. We are not capable of jumping to anywhere with a habitable world, or a data relay we could use to send a signal, or a fleet refueling station, anything like that. On the panel in front of her, she scrolled through a star map of the area within 2 light-years of what Captain Strebitch had said was their present position. It sure did look empty. A whole lot of nothing. 2.2 light-years away was a brown dwarf star, without a symbol indicating any species in the Rindaloo Coalition had a facility there, not even an automated monitoring station. The fleet doesn't know where we are because the battle group altered course when we found the debris from that civilian ship. Is there a way to see? She fiddled with the controls, then gave up. The original flight path plan of the star carrier before it altered course?
Because that original flight path is where the fleet would be searching for us?
Yes, it's here.
Jin reached over and adjusted the controls, zooming out.
At closest approach, the planned flight path was,
she squinted at the display,
about 16 light-years from here.
Hell, that's no good, Perkins said sourly.
No way can we jump that far. Our jump drive isn't capable of getting us anywhere useful from here.
She did not consider that she might have just insulted the Ruhar by disparaging their jump drive technology. Perkins wound a strand of hair around one finger, a nervous habit that seemed to fascinate the Ruhar. She pulled her hand away and bit down on a thumbnail while she thought.
We don't, she said softly, speaking to herself. We don't know that star carrier was destroyed, do we?
We saw it blow up, Biff scoffed.
No.
It was Jin's turn to look thoughtful.
We saw it get hit, just before we jumped away. We didn't see.
Her voice trailed off as she accessed controls on her workstation, recalling sensor data of the final seconds before the Rue to Stella jumped away. The audience watched anxiously as the Jarapha ship got battered,
Then the image cut off as their own ship jumped.
Run that back, Perkins ordered. Then, there's too much interference. Can you clean up the image?
There was a lot of energy saturating the battle space back then,
Jin warned as she manipulated the sensor feed.
Our ability to separate signal from noise is limited.
There.
Perkins jabbed a finger at the display excitedly.
Pause it there. No, back. There.
What am I seeing?
That looks like the Star Carrier took a direct hit amidships.
Jin examined the fuzzy data from several different sensor feeds, running the images through filters, then giving up as the data could not be cleaned up any further.
You are right. A missile struck the Star Carrier's spine just before we jumped.
So, Perkins noted with a tiny flare of hope, we don't know that ship was destroyed.
That is crazy,
Biff threw up his hands.
We can't rely on wishful thinking.
Perkins ignored the cadet leader.
What is this?
She asked about a glow in the image off to the top.
It is...
Jin pulled back.
It appears the destroyer city of Sandep jumped away less than a second before we did.
Oh, she groaned with dismay.
No, it attempted to jump away. Look at how the event horizon of their jump wormhole is distorted. They were too far inside the damping field.
She looked up to meet Perkins' eyes.
It is unlikely the Sandep survived the jump attempt.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Perkins knew her words sounded flat when she was talking about the deaths of almost 100 Ruhar. What could she say? The entire battle group was probably dead also, along with the crew of their Jirapha mothership.
That could actually be good for us.
Jin's comment surprised Perkins, and the Ruhar cadet saw that, so she explained.
The collapse of the Sandep's event horizon could have created a local spatial distortion, preventing the Bosphorak ship from jumping to pursue us.
But that battlecruiser could have jumped eventually, Perkins guessed.
Yes.
Jin scrunched up her face to recall the intricacies of jump physics, which was not specifically part of her studies.
The Bosphorak would have to fly a considerable distance through normal space to get clear of the distortion before they could jump.
Like how far? Could that battlecruiser still be there?
No. No, they would not need to fly that far before jumping. That ship's rate of acceleration is impressive.
Jin knew that because she had taken a minute to study up about their opponent after the battle.
Outstanding, Perkins muttered to herself.
Then there is no reason to think the Bosphorak are still hanging around the battle space. Biff did not like the sound of that. His ears stood up in alarm.
You cannot be suggesting we jump back into that area.
Cadet Kolsun, I am not suggesting anything. I am considering our options, and I might order a jump back into the battle space.
Her tone made it clear she was not seeking input from a former and failed mutineer.
Jin nodded, ignoring Biff. A day before, she would never have done that.
You are hoping some of our ships might have survived?
Perkins nodded curtly.
It's our best bet that I can see. The Bosphorak know our ships can't travel between stars.
She missed the fact that she had referred to Ruhar warships as our rather than your.
Once they snapped the Beetle Star Carrier in half, they might have figured their job was done and moved on.
Yes, Cadet Kolsun, that is wishful thinking, she admitted with a defiant tone.
Sometimes wishful thinking is all you've got to go on out here. Staying here and doing nothing is only wishing for a slow death.
Biff looked to Jin for help, but she looked away.
Colonel Perkins.
He pronounced her name correctly.
If the Bosphorak have not left the area, it will be certain death for us to jump back in there.
Agreed. My judgment is the Bosphorak had no tactical reason to remain in the area. For whatever purpose they stalked and hit our battle group, their mission was a complete success once they disabled that Star Carrier.
She had decided their best option for survival was to jump back to the only place in range where they might find help. Now the question was, could they do that?
Chapter 14.
Can we do it? Perkins asked, trying to decide where to float in the cramped confines of the auxiliary control center.
Can we jump?
Sure,
Derek was quick to answer. Problem is, we have no idea how to program a jump.
Colonel, I mean no idea. None of the training materials available to us even mention the subject.
Well, there's no handy-dandy jump-back feature, like call-back on a phone?
Perkins joked, though hoping that might be true.
Even if there was, ma'am, I think the jump we did under the damping effect was so sloppy, the system wouldn't know where to go back to. We need to get some smart cadets up here to help us program the jump computer.
Okay, but the drive can do that jump? Garner tells me there is plenty of power left in the capacitors.
There should be more than enough, ma'am, Irene agreed.
We jumped out of a partial damping field. That takes a lot of extra power. Jumping back should use a lot less juice. Unless the drive coils got degraded from our jump, I'll have to ask the engineering team about that.
Do it, Perkins ordered.
I'll find some cadets who have at least a basic knowledge of jump physics, she added hopefully.
Faster-than-light travel was critical to the Ruhar fleet and the whole war effort. Jump theory and navigation had to be an important topic at their training schools. Jump theory and navigation was an important topic at Ruhar training schools. Unfortunately, no cadet aboard the route to Stella had enough experience to actually program a live jump. Even the senior cadets had mostly learned jump physics and theory, not practical application. Fortunately, there was one person aboard the ship who had actual hands-on training in jump navigation, though even she had only worked with a simulator. Serkotra Tutula volunteered when she heard Perkins needed someone to assist.
Thank you, but no, you don't understand.
Irene let exasperation get the better of her.
We don't need you to assist. We need you to do it. All of it.
The two of us have absolutely no idea how any of this stuff, she waved her hands at the confusing jump controls on the display, works.
No idea.
That is unfortunate.
Tutula frowned in a very human-like expression that was much better than a smile from her species.
I will require qualified senior cadets to assist me with the calculations. The math is complicated, and verifying the calculations is a rigorous process.
Thank you. If you need anything from us, let us know, but...
Irene scowled. She hated feeling useless and helpless to control her fate.
Otherwise, we'll stay out of your way.
As we are under a time constraint, it would be best if you were not involved. I might have time to explain the process later, but...
Yeah, we get it.
Derek rubbed a hand along Irene's arm to soothe her bruised ego.
Until we learn the basic theory, watching the process won't do us any good.
Tutula, are the cadets going to be okay with the Verdcris programming one of their starships to jump?
No doubt some of them will not be pleased.
Tutula's expression was unreadably blank.
Those who refuse to participate will be noted, and I expect Fleet Command to reprimand them appropriately. If not, I will.
Bift came back to confer with Jin Garner, this time without being escorted by Sergeant Jates, who was busy motivating a team of cadets working to patch a leaky fuel tank. Jin listened to Bift's whispered words, then,
"You are suggesting I sabotage our jump drive?"
Jin asked, incredulous.
"Shh!"
Bift's head snapped around, but no one had heard her words in the noisy compartment.
"No. Only the drive control circuit,"
Bift explained, getting his natural cockiness back.
"We have to stop the alien from jumping us back to the battle space. It's insanity. It is suicide."
He reached for her shoulder for emphasis, but she pushed herself away.
"It might be risky," Jin admitted.
She was not entirely sure the jump drive coils would not explode when energized.
"What do you suggest we do?"
"We stay here and wait for rescue. Without using power for jumps and propulsion, the reactor can..."
"The reactor won't last, I told you that."
"It is amazing you got it restarted at all."
Bift flashed a grin that used to be considered charming, but now he feared most cadets saw through his attempt to flatter and manipulate them. Jin only glared at him and folded her arms, so he hurried to continue.
Yes. While the reactor is working, we use it to charge up every power cell we have, so when the reactor has to be shut down, we can stretch out life support."
"Stretch it out how long? And when that runs out, we get into dropships and then we survive in spacesuits?" "You weren't listening."
Her tone implied that was a common problem with Bift, Kolsun.
"The fleet has no idea where we are. No idea. They don't even know we are missing yet."
"Then waiting in one place is as good as any other. And we should stay right here rather than risking a jump."
"Wrong."
Jin brushed her bangs out of her eyes.
The battle space was flooded with high-energy particles. If any place in the area will attract the attention of ships searching for us, it is there, not here.
Biff kicked himself for not thinking of that fact, and he was stubborn enough not to admit when he was wrong.
You know what else was in the battle space? A Bosphorak warship. It is too risky for us to jump back in there. Jin, all you need to do is...
No. No, I won't do it. And you are not doing it either. You leave my drive circuits alone.
Anger flared in her eyes.
You will obey this alien even though you know her plan is insane?
I am obeying because it is my duty and because I agree with her. We can't stay here while our reactor shuts down, then life support fails. There is nowhere within this ship's jump radius that will allow us to survive. Our best chance is if one of our ships is still in the area of the battle.
Now you are indulging yourself in wishful thinking.
Biff turned away in disgust. How could he have once wanted such a weak woman?
I wish to live, and you have not offered a better option. Now get out of my control center.
She waved him away.
I have work to do.
Irene held up a hand to get Perkins's attention.
All stations report ready for jump, Colonel.
As ready as we're going to be, you mean?
Yes, ma'am. There isn't anything more we can check that hasn't been checked at least 3 times already. The unknowns are going to remain that way until we load power into the jump coils.
That would have to be good enough, whether Perkins liked it or not. For the record, she did not like it.
Remind me, how long after we jump until the sensors are able to give us useful data?
7 seconds for full reset, maybe 18 seconds to restore full capability, ma'am.
Irene cautioned the ship's current commander.
Problem is, the toaster's sensor suite got beat up pretty badly in the fight. We lost an entire array on the port side, and there are big gaps in the dorsal arrays.
Anything that would prevent the sensors from picking up a return echo from a Yankee search?
No. Those active pulses are so powerful I could detect a ship with my suit sensors if I were standing outside.
That won't be necessary, Strebitch.
The cadets had been appalled when they heard Perkins's plan to scan the battle space with active sensor pulses immediately after jumping in, because fleet doctrine was that stealth was life, and no one compromised stealth, especially not in a potential combat situation. Perkins's reasoning was the intense gamma-ray burst of their inbound jump would already illuminate their position to any ship in the area, and the toaster's stealth field was, well, basically toast at that point. If a stealthed Bosphorak ship was lingering around the battle space, Perkins would rather detect the enemy presence with a sensor echo than with maser bolts cutting into the route to Stella.
We will be ready to jump the hell out of there if we detect unfriendlies?
Yes, Derek called up the jump option list on his console. Short jump, then long. The quicker we have to initiate a jump, the less accurate it will be, he warned. Short long was Ruhar Fleet's standard procedure for an escape jump. Conduct a short jump to get clear of the immediate battle space, and drop off quantum resonators just before the jump to confuse enemy sensors about where the ship had jumped to. Then conduct a longer jump with the hope that by the time the enemy determined where the far end of the short jump was, the escaping ship would be long gone. Derek agreed with the thinking behind the procedure, except the route to Stella was not equipped with quantum resonators, and they would need to pause for an estimated 40 minutes after the short jump to calculate their long jump. If a Bosphorak ship were waiting for them, Derek thought the toaster was as good as dead already.
Then there's no point waiting. Sound the alarm for jump prep and start feeding power into the coils.
Perkins closed her eyes briefly and said a silent prayer.
Please, God, don't let me screw this up. People are depending on me.
The Rue to Stella jumped with fair accuracy, considering that the jump had been programmed partly by a group of third-year cadets. According to the navigation system, they missed the target point by only 14,000 miles, in space warfare that was practically on top of their target. Perkins took that as a very good omen.
Anything?
Perkins asked, with one eye on the clock and one on the sensor display. 10 seconds had gone by, and the display was still blank. Then the display lit up. All over.
Multiple contacts, Derek shouted louder than needed.
Wait, wait, he added to Irene, who had a finger poised on a button to jump them away.
All contacts are solid, Colonel.
We're not picking up a return with a fuzzy silhouette like we would if there were a stealth ship out there. There are a lot of contacts, though. He whistled. Looks like a big debris field.
Strabage, keep your finger on that button, Perkins ordered. But don't activate a jump without my order. We've got a limited number of jumps before this bucket fails us.
As the sensor data became more clear, Perkins became less tense and more fearful. Unless a Bosphorak ship had a super effective stealth field or was so far away they hadn't received a sensor return yet, the battle space appeared to be empty of threats. It was also empty of potential rescuers.
Nothing? They're all gone?
Perkins leaned over Irene's chair, her eyes flicking from one part of the display to another. The area was cluttered with drifting debris, so much that the route to Stella twice had been forced to maneuver away to avoid colliding with spinning pieces of dangerous junk. Active sensors had thoroughly scanned the area out to 500,000 miles, and there was not a single intact ship anywhere near them. In most cases, the software's ship identification system had difficulty determining what type of ship most of the debris came from because the parts were so small and torn apart.
It looks that way, ma'am, Derek concluded. I'm sorry.
We're all sorry, Bonsu. Could a ship have gotten away?
It's possible, Derek replied without a trace of hope in his voice. The system can only account for 63% of the mass that should be around us. But some of the ships, like that City of Sandep, blew up hard. There wouldn't be enough left of those ships to track the mass because a lot of the mass got converted to energy.
Any sign of the Delmian?
The forward section is gone. This is most of it, Derek indicated a loose cloud on the display.
But the aft section?
That's interesting. Looks like it's mostly together.
He enhanced the image to show a short section of the Star Carrier spine with a single empty docking platform attached to the aft engineering section.
Yeah. They took some hits there also.
As Derek continued to zoom in on the broken Star Carrier, they could see a reactor that had its plasma vented through a burn-through hole in the exterior shielding. The entire area around that reactor was scorched and melted.
That doesn't look good, Derek muttered.
Shit. Perkins shook her head. She might have gotten all their hopes up for nothing. The route to Stella still could not jump far enough to get anywhere useful, and their single functional reactor was steadily failing. All they might have accomplished was slowly dying in that lonely part of interstellar space, rather than their previous position in lonely interstellar space.
Secure from active search, she ordered. It's too dangerous to send dropships out there, with all the debris drifting around.
The real problem was chunks of debris crashing into each other, creating more debris and sending pieces careening in all directions.
Launch a recon drone. I want a full scan of what's left of the Star Carrier. If you see another piece of debris out there large enough to investigate, send another drone. We can't afford to miss anything.
They didn't miss anything because there wasn't anything to be missed. Other than the aft section of the Delmian, the largest piece of debris was the size of a dropship. The Bosphorak battlecruiser had been brutally thorough in its destruction of the Ruhar ships, so much so that Perkins wondered whether the Bosphorak captain had a personal grudge against those Ruhar. Space combat rarely left significant parts of wounded ships intact. The kinetic energy of railguns and the explosive power of ship-killer missile warheads could quickly tear unprotected ships apart, while a single hit to a reactor or jump-drive capacitors could cause a ship to destroy itself. Still, Perkins had hoped to find something useful in the debris cloud, and she was straining to keep the necessary confidence in front of her reluctant crew. The second recon drone had flown around to examine several remnants of Ruhar ships and found nothing useful, so Perkins had recalled that drone after it unfortunately displayed images demonstrating that some of the debris drifting around were shattered Ruhar bodies. She did not need the cadets seeing frozen, charred, and bloated bodies of their people. Giving up on hoping to find a miracle in the smashed remains of the Ruhar battle group, she concentrated on what remained of the Star Carrier, knowing that section of the ship was extremely unlikely to contain a living Jarraptha. She gave her cadet crew plenty of time to examine the stricken Star Carrier, assigning two additional drones to the search, and not asking Jin for her opinion until 6 hours had passed.
What do you think?
Perkins asked as she handed a squeeze bulb of hot claw to the senior cadet.
Is anything there salvageable? Useful to us?
No.
Jin needed the claw to keep herself awake.
Their normal space propulsion system is scrap. A third of it is simply sheared away. Whatever hit there, it tore the power couplings loose. That ship isn't going to move on its own again.
I saw that. What about the reactors? One of them looked fairly intact.
There is one reactor that vented its plasma and shut down properly.
Please,
before you ask, no. We can't get anything useful from that Star Carrier's reactor. To restart our own reactor, I was able to rely on instructions that walked us through every step in great detail. And as you remember, we still had to abort the restart sequence 3 times because something went wrong that the procedures didn't anticipate. With a Geraptha reactor, we would be starting from absolute zero.
Cadet, I have every confidence. You shouldn't. It is impossible.
Wait. Jin held up a hand.
Please, Colonel.
That reactor vented its plasma, but it is damaged. There are cracks in the exterior sheathing, and the containment magnets inside have become detached from their mounts. We can't fix it. I do not think even the Geraptha could repair that reactor without a shipyard capable of heavy-duty work.
It is impossible.
Impossible.
She looked at Perkins from one eye to another, seeking understanding as if that particular word could not translate properly.
Impossible, I understand.
Cadet, you've done a remarkable job. I can't ask for more.
I accept there is no potential for using a Geraptha reactor to power our life support systems.
Thank you, Colonel Perkins.
Jin shuddered slightly with relief and fatigue.
No reactor, then.
What about...
Contact!
Derek called excitedly over Perkins' Z-phone.
We got something out there, ma'am. Looks like a Geraptha escape pod.
Escape pod? Emily found her pilot's excitement to be infectious.
Just one? Are there survivors aboard?
Just the one,
Derek reported slowly as he reviewed the data on his console, hoping for better news.
One intact. We found others that are damaged. This is the first one generating power. It began pinging a distress call a few seconds ago. Maybe it needed to get a certain distance from the battle space before it activated, or maybe it has a timer.
Or maybe it picked up our signals,
Perkins suggested.
Survivors?
All we're getting is a location ping, Colonel. We're too far away to see inside with our sensors. It could be empty, but it is pinging, and I don't know if a Geraptha pod would do that unless it was occupied. I couldn't find anything in the ship's database about operating procedures for Geraptha gear.
Ah, damn it. Please tell me the debris field is relatively clear between us and that pod.
Not a chance, ma'am.
Damn it.
All right, send a drone.
The drone reported one living Geraptha was inside the escape pod, though it was in a state of semi-hibernation caused by the pod's mechanisms.
I don't suppose the Beatles equipped their pods with the capability to rendezvous with a rescue vessel?
Perkins asked hopefully.
No, ma'am.
Irene turned to look up at their captain.
I worked with the cadet to research everything the ship's database knows about those pods, and they have a very limited ability to maneuver. Basically, they can move to avoid collisions, but... that pod out there has used up all its fuel so it didn't crash into the debris cloud. The casing has dents and scratches from impact already. I hope it isn't damaged. We need to go out there and bring it to us.
How did I know you were going to say that?
Perkins crossed her arms as she floated behind the pilot couches.
I suppose you are first in line to volunteer?
Well, Colonel.
Irene winked at Derek. They had tossed a coin and Derek lost.
If you send 2 cadet pilots, it might look like you are not willing to risk human lives.
Right.
But if you go with a cadet, I am clearly not playing favorites.
Perkins rolled her eyes.
Christ, Strebitch, you're right about this one.
Of course, she mused with a hand rubbing her chin. I could send to Tula with a Ruhar cadet, which would make it an interspecies rescue operation. Seeing the crestfallen look on Irene's face, she took pity on her pilot.
Relax, Strebitch. You sold me on the idea.
Take Tutula and a cadet pilot to be safe.
Go bring that beetle here to us.
The Beetle was a young machinist's mate named Ernst Dahl, who was barely older than the Ruhar cadets, as he had been aboard the Deal Me In as his first assignment out of school. The translator told Perkins that Dahl's rank of Arlon was something like junior ensign, or probationary ensign, so he was certainly not an experienced senior officer. He was overjoyed to be alive when the pod automatically revived him upon being brought into the pressurized environment of the